slightly behind her, and it made her shirt transparent. He could see the outside curve of her breast. It swelled gently past the strap of her shoulder holster and fell away to the flatness of her waist. It moved slightly as she breathed.
"Get to work, Reacher," she said.
This is the tense time. You drive by, not fast, not slow. You look carefully. You keep on going up the road a little, and then you stop and you turn around and you drive back. You park at the curb, leaving the car facing the right direction. You switch the engine off. You take the keys out and put them in your pocket. You put your gloves on. It's cold outside, so the gloves will look okay. You get out of the car. You stand still for a second, listening hard. And then you turn a complete circle, slowly looking again. This is the tense time. This is the time when you must decide to abort or proceed. Think, think, think. You keep it dispassionate. It's just an operational judgment, after all. Your training helps. You decide to proceed. You close the car door, quietly. You walk into the driveway. You walk to the door. You knock. You stand there. The door opens. She lets you in. She's glad to see you. Surprised, a little confused at first. Then delighted. You talk for a moment. You keep on talking until the time is right. You'll know the moment when it comes. You keep on talking. The moment comes. You stand still for a second, testing it. You make your move. You explain she has to do exactly what you tell her. She agrees, of course, because she has no choice. You tell her you'd like her to look like she's having fun while she's doing it. You explain that'll make the whole thing more agreeable for you. She nods happily, willing to please. She smiles. The smile is forced and artificial, which spoils it somewhat, but it can't be helped. Something is better than nothing. You make her show you the master bathroom. She stands there like a real estate agent showing it off. The tub is fine. It's like a lot of tubs you've seen. You tell her to bring the paint inside. You supervise her all the way. It takes her 5 trips, in and out of the house, up and down the stairs. There's a lot to carry. She's huffing and puffing. She's starting to sweat, even though the fall weather is cold. You remind her about the smile. She puts it back in place. It looks more like a grimace. You tell her to find something to lever the lids off with. She nods happily and tells you about a screwdriver in the kitchen drawer. You walk with her. She opens the drawer and finds the screwdriver. You walk with her back to the bathroom. You tell her to take the lids off, one by one. She's calm. She kneels next to the first can. She works the tip of the screwdriver in under the metal flange of the lid and eases it upward. She works around it in a circle. The lid sucks off. The chemical smell of the paint fills the air. She moves on to the next can, then the next. She's working hard, working quickly. You tell her to be careful. Any mess, she'll be punished. You tell her to smile. She smiles. She works. The last lid comes off. You pull the folded refuse sack from your pocket. You tell her to place her clothes in it. She's confused. Which clothes? The clothes you're wearing, you tell her. She nods and smiles. Kicks off her shoes. Their weight pulls the folded bag into shape. She's wearing socks. She tugs them off. Drops them in the bag. She unbuttons her jeans. Hops from foot to foot, taking them off. They go in the bag. She unbuttons her shirt. Shrugs it off. Drops it in the bag. She reaches back and fiddles with the catch on her bra. Pulls it off. Her breasts are swinging free. She slips her underpants down and balls them with the bra and drops them in the bag. She's naked. You tell her to smile. You make her carry the bag down to the front door. You walk behind her. She props the bag against the door. You take her back to the bathroom. You make her empty the cans into the tubs, slowly, carefully, one by one. She concentrates hard, tongue between her teeth. The cans are heavy and awkward. The paint is thick. It smells. It runs slowly into the tub. The level creeps up, green and oily. You tell her she's done well. You tell her you're pleased. The paint is in the tub, and there are no drips anywhere. She smiles, delighted at the praise. Then you tell her the next part is harder. She has to take the empty cans back where she got them. But now she's naked, so she has to make sure nobody can see, and she has to run. She nods. You tell her now the cans are empty, they weigh less, so she can carry more each trip. She nods again. She understands. She threads them onto her fingers, 5 empty cans in each hand. She carries them downstairs. You make her wait. You ease the door open and check. Look and listen. You send her out. She runs all the way there. She replaces the cans. She runs all the way back, breasts bouncing. It's cold outside. You tell her to stand still and get her breath. You remind her about the smile. She bobs her head apologetically and comes back with the grimace. You take her up to the bathroom again. The screwdriver is still on the floor. You ask her to pick it up. You tell her to make marks on her face with it. She's confused. You explain. Deep scratches will do, you tell her. 3 or 4 of them. Deep enough to draw blood. She smiles and nods. Raises the screwdriver. Scrapes it down the left side of her face, with the blade turned so the point is digging in. A livid red line appears, 5 inches long. Make the next one harder, you say. She nods. The line bleeds. Good, you say. Do another. She scratches another, and another. Good, you say. Now make the last one really hard. She nods and smiles, drags the blade down. The skin tears, blood flows. Good girl, you say. She's still holding the screwdriver. You tell her to get into the bath, slowly and carefully. She puts her right foot in, then her left. She's standing in the paint up to her calves. You tell her to sit down slowly. She sits. The paint is up over her waist, touching the underside of her breasts. You tell her to lie back slowly and carefully. She slides down into the paint. The level rises 2 inches below the lip of the tub. Now you smile. Just right. You tell her what to do. She doesn't understand at first because it's a very odd thing to be asked. You explain carefully. She nods. Her hair is thick with paint. She slides down. Now only her face is showing. She tilts her head back. Her hair floats. She uses her fingers to help her. They're slick and dripping with paint. She does exactly what she's been told. She gets it right the first time. Her eyes jam open with panic, and then she dies. You wait 5 minutes, just leaning over the tub, not touching anything. Then you do the only thing she can't do for herself. It gets paint on your right glove. Then you press down on her forehead with a fingertip, and she slips under the surface. You peel your right glove off inside out. Check the left one. It's okay. You put your right hand in your pocket for safety, and you keep it there. This is the only time your prints are exposed. You carry the soiled glove in your left hand and walk downstairs in the silence. Slip the glove into the refuse sack with her clothes. Open the door. Listen and watch. Carry the sack outside. Turn around and close the door behind you. Walk down the driveway to the road. Pause behind the car and slip the clean glove in the sack, too. Pop the trunk lid and place the sack inside. Open the door and slide in behind the wheel. Take the keys from your pocket and start the engine. Buckle your belt and check the mirror. Drive away. Not fast, not slow. The Callan file started with a summary of her military career. The career was 4 years long, and the summary ran to 48 lines of type. His own name was mentioned once in connection with the debacle at the end. He found he remembered her pretty well. She had been a small, round woman, cheerful and happy. He guessed she had joined the army with no very clear idea of why. There's a definite type of person who takes the same route. Maybe from a large family, comfortable with sharing, good at team sports in school, academically proficient without being a scholar, they just drift toward it. They see it as an extension of what they've already known. Probably they don't see themselves as fighters. But they know for every person who holds a gun, the Army offers 100 other niches where there are trades to be learned and qualifications to be earned. Callan had passed out of basic training and gone straight to the ordnance storerooms. She was a sergeant within 20 months. She shuffled paper and sent consignments around the world pretty much like her contemporaries back home, except her consignments were guns and shells instead of tomatoes or shoes or automobiles. She worked at Fort Wythe near Chicago in a warehouse full of the stink of gun oil and the noise of clattering forklifts. She had been content at first. Then the rough banter had gotten too much, and her captain and her major had started stepping over the line and talking dirty and acting physical. She was no shrinking violet, but the pawing and the leering eventually brought her to Reacher's office. Then after she quit, she went to Florida, to a beach town on the Atlantic 40 miles north of where it stopped being too expensive. She got married there, got separated there, lived there a year, then died there. The file was full of notes and photographs about where, and nothing much about how. Her house was a modern one-story, crouching under an overhanging roof made of orange tile. The crime scene photographs showed no damage to any doors or windows, no disruption inside. A white-tiled bathroom with a tub full of green paint, and a slick, indeterminate shape floating in it. The autopsy showed nothing at all. The paint was designed to be tough and weatherproof, and it had a molecular structure designed to cling and penetrate anything it was slapped onto. It covered 100% of the body's external area, and it had seeped into the eyes and the nose and the mouth and the throat. Removing it removed the skin. There was no evidence of bruising or trauma. The toxicology was clear. No phenol injection to the heart, no air embolisms. There are many clever ways to kill a person, and the Florida pathologists knew all of them, and they couldn't find any evidence of any of them.
Well? Harper said.
Reacher shrugged. She had freckles. I remember that. A year in the Florida sun, she must have looked pretty good.
You liked her?
He nodded. She was okay. The final third of the file was some of the most exhaustive crime scene forensics he had ever heard of. The analysis was microscopic, literally. Every particle of dust or fiber in her house had been vacuumed up and analyzed. But there was no evidence of any intruder, not the slightest sign.
A very clever guy, Reacher said.
Harper said nothing in reply. He pushed Callan's folder to one side and opened Cook's. It followed the same format in its condensed narrative structure. She was different from Callan, in that she had obviously aimed for the Army right from the start. Her grandfather and her father had been Army men, which creates a kind of military aristocracy, the way certain families see it. She had recognized the clash between her gender and her career intention pretty early. And there were notes about her demands to join her high school ROTC. She had begun her battles early. She had been an officer candidate and had started out a second lieutenant. She had gone straight to war plans, which is where the brainy people waste their time assuming that when push comes to shove, your friends stay your friends and your enemies stay your enemies. She had been promoted first lieutenant and posted to NATO in Brussels and started a relationship with her colonel. When she didn't get promoted captain early enough, she complained about him. Reacher remembered it well. There was no harassment involved, certainly not in the sense that Callan had endured. No strangers had pinched her or squeezed her or made lewd gestures at her with oily gun barrels. But the rules had changed, so that sleeping with somebody you commanded was no longer allowed. So Cook's colonel went down and then ate his pistol. She quit and flew home from Belgium to a lakeside cottage in New Hampshire, where she was eventually found dead in a tub full of setting paint. The New Hampshire pathologists and forensic scientists told the same story their Florida counterparts had, which was absolutely no story at all. The notes and the photographs were the same, but different. A gray cedar house crowded by trees, an undamaged door, an undisturbed interior, folksy bathroom decor dominated by the dense green contents of the tub. Reacher skimmed through and closed the folder.
"What do you think?" Harper asked.
"I think the paint is weird," Reacher said.
"Why?"
He shrugged. "It's so circular, isn't it? It eliminates evidence on the bodies, which reduces risk. But getting it and transporting it creates risk.
And it's like a deliberate clue, Harper said. It underlines the motive. It's definite confirmation it's an army guy. It's like a taunt.
Lamar says it has psychological significance. She says he's reclaiming them for the military.
Harper nodded. By taking their clothes, too.
But if he hates them enough to kill them, why would he want to reclaim them?
I don't know. A guy like this, who knows how he thinks?
Lamar thinks she knows how he thinks, Reacher said. Lorraine Stanley's file was the last of the three. Her history was similar to Callan's, but more recent. She was younger. She had been a sergeant, bottom of the totem pole, in a giant quartermaster facility in Utah, the only woman in the place. She had been pestered since day one. Her competence had been questioned. One night, her barrack was broken into, and all her uniform trousers were stolen. She reported for duty the next morning, wearing her regulation skirt. The next night, all her underwear was stolen. The next morning, she was wearing the skirt and nothing underneath. Her lieutenant called her into his office, made her stand easy in the middle of the room, one foot either side of a large mirror laid on the floor, while he yelled at her for a paperwork snafu. The whole of the personnel roster filed in and out of the office throughout, getting a good look at the reflection in the mirror. The lieutenant ended up in prison, and Stanley ended up serving out another year, and then living alone and dying alone in San Diego, in the little bungalow shown in the crime scene photographs, in which the California pathologists and forensics people had found absolutely nothing at all.
How old are you? Reacher asked.
Me? Harper said. 29. I told you that. It's an FAQ.
From Colorado, right?
Aspen.
Family?
Two sisters, one brother.
Older or younger?
All older. I'm the baby.
Parents?
Dad's a pharmacist. Mom helps him out.
You take vacations when you were kids?
She nodded. Sure. Grand Canyon, Painted Desert, all over. One year we camped in Yellowstone.
You drove there, right?
She nodded again. Sure. Big station wagon full of kids, happy family sort of thing. What's this about?
What do you remember about the drives?
She made a face. They were endless.
Exactly.
Exactly what?
This is a real big country.
So?
Caroline Cook was killed in New Hampshire, and Lorraine Stanley was killed 3 weeks later in San Diego. That's about as far apart as you can get, right? Maybe 3,500 miles by road, maybe more.
Is he traveling by road?
Reacher nodded. He's got hundreds of gallons of paint to haul around.
Maybe he's got a stockpile stashed away someplace.
That just makes it worse. Unless his stash just happened to be on a direct line between where he's based now in New Hampshire and Southern California, he'd have to detour to get it. It would add distance, maybe a lot of distance.
So?
So, he's got a 3,000-4,000-mile road trip, plus surveillance time on Lorraine Stanley. Could he do that in a week?
Harper made a face. Call it 70 hours at 55 miles an hour,
which he couldn't average. He'd pass through towns and road construction, and he wouldn't break the speed limit. A guy this meticulous isn't going to risk some trooper sniffing around his vehicle. Hundreds of gallons of camouflage base coat is going to arouse some suspicions these days, right?
So call it 100 hours on the road?
At least. Plus a day or two surveillance when he gets there. That's more than a week in practical terms. It's 10 or 11 days. Maybe 12.
So?
You tell me.
This is not some guy working 2 weeks on, 1 week off.
Reacher nodded. No, it's not. They walked outside and around toward the block with the cafeteria in it. The weather had settled to what fall should be. The air was 10 degrees warmer, but still crisp. The lawns were green and the sky was a shattering blue. The dampness had blown away and the leaves on the surrounding trees looked dry and 2 shades lighter.
I feel like staying outside, Reacher said.
You need to work, Harper said.
I read the damn files. Reading them over again isn't going to help me any. I need to do some thinking.
You think better outside?
Generally.
Okay, come to the range. I need to qualify on handguns.
You're not qualified already?
She smiled. Of course I am. We have to requalify every month. Regulations.
They took sandwiches from the cafeteria and ate as they walked. The outdoor pistol range was Sunday quiet.
a large space the size of a hockey rink, bermed on three sides with high earth walls. There were six separate firing lanes made out of shoulder-high concrete walls running all the way down to six separate targets. The targets were heavy paper, clipped into steel frames. Each paper was printed with a picture of a crouching felon, with target rings radiating out from his heart. Harper signed in with the range master and handed him her gun. He reloaded it with six shells and handed it back together with two sets of ear defenders. "Take lane three," he said. Lane three was in the center. There was a black line painted on the concrete floor.
75 feet, Harper said.
She stood square on and slipped the ear defenders into position, raised the gun two-handed. Her legs were apart and her knees slightly bent. Her hips were forward and her shoulders back. She loosed off the six shots in a stream, half a second between them. Reacher watched the tendons in her hand. They were tight, rocking the muzzle up and down a fraction each time she pulled.
"Clear,"
she said. He looked at her.
"That means you go get the target," she said.
He expected to see the hits arranged on a vertical line, maybe a foot long, and when he got down to the other end of the lane, that is exactly what he found. There were two holes in the heart, two in the next ring, and two in the ring connecting the throat with the stomach. He unclipped the paper and carried it back.
2 fives, 2 fours, 2 threes, she said. 24 points. I pass, just.
You should use your left arm more, he said.
How?
Take all the weight with your left, and just use your right for pulling the trigger. She paused.
Show me,
she said. He stepped close behind her and stretched around with his left arm. She raised the gun in her right, and he cupped her hand in his. Relax the arm, he said. Let me take the weight. His arms were long, but hers were too. She shuffled backward and pressed hard against him. He leaned forward, rested his chin on the side of her head. Her hair smelled good. Okay, let it float, he said. She clicked the trigger on the empty chamber a couple of times. The muzzle was rock steady.
Feels good, she said.
Go get some more shells. She peeled away from in front of him and walked back to the rangemaster's cubicle and got another clip, part loaded with six. He moved into the next lane where there was a new target. She met him there and nestled back against him and raised her gun hand. He reached around her and cupped it and took the weight. She leaned back against him, fired twice. He saw the holes appear in the target, maybe an inch apart in the center ring. See? He said. Let the left do the work.
Sounds like a political statement.
She stayed where she was, leaning back against him. He could feel the rise and fall of her breathing. He stepped away from behind her and she tried again, by herself. Two shots, fast. The shell cases rang on the concrete. Two more holes appeared in the heart ring. There was a tight cluster of four in a diamond shape a business card would have covered. She nodded.
You want the last two?
She stepped close and handed him the pistol, butt first. It was a Sig Sauer, identical to the one Lamar had held next to his head throughout the car ride into Manhattan. He stood with his back to the target and weighed the gun in his hand. Then he spun abruptly and fired the two bullets, one into each of the target's eyes. That's how I'd do it, he said. If I was real mad with somebody, that's what I'd do. I wouldn't mess around with a damn tub and 20 gallons of paint. They met Blake on the way back to the library room. He looked aimless and agitated all at the same time. There was worry in his face. He had a new problem.
Lamar's father died, he said.
Stepfather, Reacher said.
Whatever. He died early this morning. The hospital in Spokane called for her. Now I've got to call her at home.
Give her our condolences, Harper said.
Blake nodded vaguely and walked away.
He should take her off the case, Reacher said.
Harper nodded.
Maybe he should, but he won't.
And she wouldn't agree anyway. Her job is all she's got. Reacher said nothing. Harper pulled the door and ushered him back into the room with the oak tables and the leather chairs and the files. Reacher sat down and checked his watch. 3:20. Maybe 2 more hours of daydreaming, and then he could eat and escape to the solitude of his room. It was 3 hours in the end, and it wasn't daydreaming. He sat and stared into space and thought hard. Harper watched him, anxious. He took the file folders and arranged them on the table. Callan's at the bottom right, Stanley's at the bottom left, Cook's at the top right, and stared at them, musing about the geography again. He leaned back and closed his eyes.
"Making any progress?" Harper asked.
"I need a list of the 91 women," he said.
"Okay," she said.
He waited with his eyes closed and heard her leave the room. Enjoyed the warmth and the silence for a long moment, and then she was back. He opened his eyes and saw her leaning over near him and handing him another thick blue file. "Pencil," he said. She backed away to a drawer and found a pencil, rolled it across the table to him. He opened the new file and started reading. First item was a Defense Department printout, 4 pages stapled together, 91 names in alphabetical order. He recognized some of them. Rita Semeca was there, the woman he'd mentioned to Blake. She was next to Lorraine Stanley. Then there was a matching list with addresses, most of them obtained through the VA's medical insurance operation or mail forwarding instructions. Semeca lived in Oregon. Then there was a thick sheaf of background information. Army post-discharge intelligence reports, extensive for some of the women, sketchy for others, but altogether enough for a basic conclusion. Reacher flipped back and forth between pages and went to work with the pencil, and 20 minutes later counted up the marks he'd made. "It was 11 women," he said, "not 91.
"It was?"
Harper said. He nodded. 11, he said again. 8 left, not 88.
"Why?"
"Lots of reasons. 91 was always absurd. Who would seriously target 91 women? 5 1/4 years, it's not credible. A guy this smart would break it down into something manageable, like 11.
"But how?"
"By limiting himself to what's feasible. A subcategory. What else did Callan and Cook and Stanley have in common?"
"What?"
"They were alone. Positively and unequivocally alone. Unmarried or separated. Single-family houses in the suburbs of the countryside."
"And that's crucial?"
"Of course it is. Think about the M.O. He needs somewhere quiet and lonely and isolated. No interruptions and no witnesses nearby. He has to get all that paint into the house, so look at this list. There are married women, women with new babies, women living with family, parents, women in apartment houses and condos, farms, communes even, women gone back to college. But he wants women who live alone, in houses." Harper shook her head.
"There are more than 11 of those. We did the research. I think it's more than 30, about a third."
"But you had to check. I'm talking about women who are obviously living alone and isolated, at first glance. Because we have to assume the guy hasn't got anybody doing research for him. He's working alone in secret. All he's got is this list to study."
"But that's our list."
"Not exclusively. It's his, too. All this information came straight from the military, right? He had this list before you did." 43 miles away, slightly east of north, the exact same list was lying open on a polished desk in a small windowless office in the darkness of the Pentagon's interior. It was 2 Xerox generations newer than Reacher's version, but it was otherwise identical. All the same pages were there, and they had 11 marks on them against 11 names. Not hasty check marks in pencil like Reacher had scrawled, but neat underlinings done with a fountain pen and a beveled ruler held away from the paper so the ink wouldn't smudge. 3 of the 11 names had second lines struck through them. The list was framed on the desk by the uniformed forearms of the office's occupant. They were flat on the wood, and the wrists were cocked upward to keep the hands clear of the surface. The left hand held a ruler. The right hand held a pen. The left hand moved and placed the ruler exactly horizontal along the inked line under a 4th name. Then it slid upward a fraction and rested across the name itself. The right hand moved and the pen scored a thick line straight through it. Then the pen lifted off the page.
"So what do we do about it?"
Harper asked. Reacher leaned back and closed his eyes again. "I think you should gamble," he said. "I think you should stake out the surviving 8 around the clock, and I think the guy will walk into your arms within 16 days. She sounded uncertain.
"Hell of a gamble," she said. It's very tenuous. You're guessing about what he's guessing about when he looks at the list.
I'm supposed to be representative of the guy, so what I guess should be what he guesses, right?
Suppose you're wrong. As opposed to what?
The progress you're making?
She still sounded uncertain.
Okay. I guess it's a valid theory, worth pursuing. But maybe they thought of it already.
Nothing ventured, nothing gained, right?
She was quiet for a second.
Okay. Talk to Lamar first thing tomorrow.
He opened his eyes. You think she'll be here?
Harper nodded.
She'll be here.
Won't there be a funeral for her father?
Harper nodded again.
There'll have to be a funeral, obviously, but she won't go. She'd miss her own funeral, a case like this.
Okay. But you do the talking. And talk to Blake instead. Keep it away from Lamar.
Why?
Because her sister clearly lives alone, remember? So her odds just went all the way down to 8-1. Blake will have to pull her off now.
If he agrees with you.
He should. Maybe he will, but he won't pull her off. He should. Maybe, but he won't. Reacher shrugged. Then don't bother telling him anything. I'm just wasting my time here. The guy's an idiot.
Don't say that. You need to cooperate. Think about Jody.
He closed his eyes again and thought about Jody. She seemed a long way away. He thought about her for a long time.
Let's go eat, Harper said. Then I'll go talk to Blake.
43 miles away, slightly east of North, the uniformed man was staring at the paper, motionless. There was a look on his face appropriate to a man making slow progress through a complicated undertaking. Then there was a knock at his door. Wait, he called. He clicked the ruler down onto the wood and capped his pen and clipped it into his pocket, folded the list and opened a drawer in his desk and slipped the list inside and weighted it down with a book. The book was a Bible, King James Version, black calfskin binding. He placed the ruler flat on top of the Bible and slid the drawer closed, took keys from his pocket and locked the drawer, put the keys back in his pocket and moved in his chair and straightened his jacket. Come, he called. The door opened, and a corporal stepped inside and saluted.
Your car is here, Colonel, he said.
Okay, Corporal, the colonel said. The skies above Quantico were still clear, but the crispness in the air was plummeting toward a real night chill. Darkness was creeping in from the east, behind the buildings. Reacher and Harper walked quickly, and the lights along the path came on in sequence, following their pace, as if their passing was switching the power. They ate alone at a table for two in a different part of the cafeteria. They walked back to the main building through full darkness. They rode the elevator, and she unlocked his door with her key.
Thanks for your input, she said.
He said nothing.
And thanks for the handgun tutorial, she said.
He nodded. My pleasure.
It's a good technique.
An old master sergeant taught it to me. She smiled.
No, not the shooting technique. The tutorial technique.
He nodded again, remembering her back pressed close against his chest, her hips jammed against his, her hair in his face, her feel, her smell. Showing is always better than telling, I guess, he said.
Can't beat it, she replied.
She closed the door on him, and he heard her walk away. Chapter 14. He woke early, before daybreak, stood at the window for a spell, wrapped in a towel, staring out into the darkness. It was cold again. He shaved and showered. He was halfway through the bureau's bottle of shampoo. He dressed standing next to the bed, took his coat from the closet and put it on, ducked back into the bathroom and clipped his toothbrush into the inside pocket, just in case today was the day. He sat on the bed with the coat wrapped around him against the cold and waited for Harper. But when the key went into the lock and the door pressed open, it wasn't Harper standing there. It was Poulton. He was keeping his face deliberately blank, and Reacher felt the first stirrings of triumph.
"Where's Harper?"
he asked.
"Off the case,"
Bolton said.
Did she talk to Blake?
Last night.
And?
Bolton shrugged.
And nothing.
You're ignoring my input?
You're not here for input.
Reacher nodded.
Okay.
Ready for breakfast?
Bolton nodded back.
Sure. The sun was coming up in the east and sending color into the sky. There was no cloud, no damp, no wind. It was a pleasant walk through the early gloom. The place felt busy again, Monday morning, the start of a new week. Blake was at the usual table in the cafeteria over by the window. Lamar was sitting with him. She was wearing a black blouse in place of her customary cream. It was slightly faded, like it had been washed many times. There was coffee on the table and mugs and milk and sugar and donuts, but no newspapers.
I was sorry to hear the news from Spokane, Reacher said.
Lamar nodded silently.
I offered her time off, Blake said. She's entitled to compassionate leave.
Reacher looked at him.
You don't need to explain yourself to me.
In the midst of life is death, Lamar said.
That's something you learn pretty quickly around here.
You're now going to the funeral?
Lamar took a teaspoon and balanced it across her forefinger, stared down at it.
Allison hasn't called me, she said. I don't know what the arrangements are going to be.
You didn't call her?
She shrugged.
I'd feel like I was intruding.
I don't think Allison would agree with that.
She looked straight at him.
But I just don't know.
There was silence. Reacher turned a mug over and poured coffee.
We need to get to work, Blake said.
You didn't like my theory? Reacher said.
It's a guess, not a theory, Blake said back. We can all guess as much as we want to, but we can't turn our backs on 80 women just because we enjoy guessing.
Would they notice the difference? Reacher asked. He took a long sip of coffee and looked at the donuts. They were wrinkled and hard, probably Saturdays.
So you're not going to pay attention? He asked.
Blake shrugged.
I gave it some consideration.
Well, give it some more, because the next woman to die will be one of the 11 I marked, and it'll be on your head.
Blake said nothing, and Reacher pushed his chair back.
I want pancakes, he said. I don't like the look of those donuts.
He stood up before they could object and stepped away toward the center of the room. Stopped at the first table with a New York Times on it. It belonged to a guy on his own. He was reading the sports. The front section was discarded to his left. Reacher picked it up. The story he was waiting for was right there, front page below the fold.
Can I borrow this? He asked.
The guy with the interest in sports nodded without looking. Reacher tucked the paper under his arm and walked to the serving counter. Breakfast was set out like a buffet. He helped himself to a stack of pancakes and ate rashers of bacon, added syrup until the plate was swimming. He was going to need the nutrition. He had a long journey ahead, and he was probably going to be walking the first part of it.
He came back to the table and squatted awkwardly to get the plate down without spilling the syrup or dropping the newspaper. He propped the paper in front of his plate and started to eat. Then he pretended to notice the headline.
Well, look at that, he said with his mouth full.
The headline read, Gang Warfare Explodes in Lower Manhattan, Leaves 6 Dead. The story recounted a brief and deadly turf war between two rival protection rackets. One of them allegedly Chinese, the other allegedly Syrian. Automatic firearms and machetes had been used. The body count ran 4-2 in favor of the Chinese. Among the four dead on the Syrian side was the alleged gang leader, a suspected felon named Almar Petrosian. There were quotes from the NYPD and the FBI and background reporting about the 100-year history of protection rackets in New York City, the Chinese tongs, the jockeying between different ethnic groups for their business, which reputedly ran to billions of dollars nationwide.
Well, look at that, Reacher said again.
They had already looked at it. That was clear.
They were all turned away from him.
Blake was staring through the window at the streaks of dawn in the sky. Bolton had his eyes fixed on the back wall. Lamar was still studying her teaspoon.
Kozo call you to confirm it? Reacher asked.
Nobody said a thing, which was the same as a yes. Reacher smiled.
Life's a bitch, right?
he said. You get a hook into me, and suddenly the hook isn't there anymore. Fate's a funny thing, isn't it?
Fate,
Blake repeated. So let me get this straight, Reacher said. Harper wouldn't play ball with the femme fatale thing, and now old Petrosian is dead, so you got no more cards to play, and you're not listening to a word I say anyway, so is there a reason why I shouldn't walk right out of here?
Lots of reasons, Blake said.
There was silence. None of them good enough, Reacher said. He stood up and stepped away from the table again. Nobody tried to stop him. He walked out of the cafeteria and out through the glass doors into the chill of dawn. Started walking. He walked all the way out to the guardhouse on the perimeter, ducked under the barrier and dropped his visitor's pass on the road, walked on and turned the corner and entered marine territory. He kept to the middle of the pavement and reached the first clearing after a half mile. There was a cluster of vehicles and a number of quiet, watchful men. They let him go on. Walking was unusual, but not illegal. He reached the second clearing 30 minutes after leaving the cafeteria. He walked through it and kept on going. He heard the car behind him 5 minutes later. He stopped and turned and waited for it. It came near enough for him to see past the dazzle of its running lights. It was Harper, which is what he had expected. She was alone. She drew level with him and buzzed her window down. "Hello, Reacher," she said. He nodded, said nothing.
"Want a ride?" she asked.
"Out or back?"
"Wherever you decide."
I-95 on ramp will do it, going north.
"Hitchhiking?"
He nodded. "I've got no money for a plane." He slid in next to her and she accelerated gently away, heading out. She was in her second suit, and her hair was loose. It spilled all over her shoulders.
"They tell you to bring me back?"
he asked. She shook her head.
"They decided you're useless. Nothing to contribute is what they said."
He smiled. "So now I'm supposed to get all boiled up with indignation and storm back in there and prove them wrong?" She smiled back.
"Something like that. They spent 10 minutes discussing the best approach. Lamar decided they should appeal to your ego."
"That's what happens when you're a psychologist who studied landscape gardening in school."
"I guess so."
They drove on through the wooded curves past the last marine clearing. "But she's right," he said. "I've got nothing to contribute. Nobody's going to catch this guy. He's too smart. Too smart for me, that's for damn sure." She smiled again.
"A little psychology of your own? Trying to leave with a clear conscience?"
He shook his head. "My conscience is always clear."
"Is it clear about Petrosian?"
"Why shouldn't it be?"
"Hell of a coincidence, don't you think? They threaten you with Petrosian, and he's dead within 3 days?"
"Just dumb luck."
"Yeah, luck. You know I didn't tell them I was outside Trent's office all day."
"Why not?"
"I was covering my ass."
He looked at her. "And what's Trent's office got to do with anything?" She shrugged.
"I don't know, but I don't like coincidences."
"They happen time to time, obviously."
"Nobody in the Bureau likes coincidences."
"So?"
She shrugged again. "So they could, you know, dig around. Might make it hard for you later."
He smiled again. "This is phase 2 of the approach, right?" She smiled back, and then the smile exploded into a laugh.
"Yeah, phase 2. There are about a dozen still to go. Some of them are real good. You want to hear them all?"
"Not really. I'm not going back. They're not listening." She nodded and drove on, paused before the junction with the interstate, and then swooped north up the ramp.
"I'll take you to the next one," she said. "Nobody uses this one except Bureau people, and none of them is going to give you a ride."
He nodded. "Thanks, Harper."
"Jody's home," she said. "I called Kozo's office. Apparently they had a little surveillance going. She's been away. She got back this morning in a taxi. Looked like she'd come from the airport. Looks like she's working from home today."
He smiled. "Okay, so now I'm definitely out of here."
"We need your input, you know."
"You're not listening."
"You need to make them listen," she said.
"This is phase 3?
"No, this is me. I mean it."
He was silent for a long moment. Then he nodded. "So why won't they listen?"
pride, maybe? She said.
They need somebody's input, he said. That's for sure. But not mine. I don't have the resources, and I don't have the authority.
To do what?
To take it out of their hands. They're wasting their time with this profiling shit. It won't get them anywhere. They need to work the clues.
There aren't any clues.
Yes, there are. How smart the guy is, and the paint, and the geography, and how quiet the scenes are. They're all clues. They should work with them. They've got to mean something. Starting with the motive is starting at the wrong end.
I'll pass that on.
She pulled off the highway and stopped at the cross street. You gonna get into trouble? He asked.
For failing to bring you back? She said. Probably.
He was silent. She smiled.
That was phase 10, she said. I'll be perfectly okay.
I hope so, he said, and got out of the car. He walked north across the street to the ramp and stood all alone and watched her car slide under the bridge and turn back south. A male hitchhiker, standing 6'5" and weighing 230 pounds, is on the cusp of acceptability for easy rides. Generally, women won't stop for him because they see a threat. Men can be just as nervous. But Reacher was showered and shaved and clean and dressed quietly. That shortened the odds, and there were enough trucks on the road with big, confident owner drivers that he was back in New York City within 7 hours of starting out. He was quiet most of the 7 hours, partly because the trucks were too noisy for conversation, and partly because he wasn't in the mood for talking. The old hobo demon was whispering to him again. Where are you going? Back to Jody, of course. Okay, smart guy, but what else? What the hell else? Yard work behind your house? Painting the damn walls? He sat next to a succession of kindly drivers and felt his brief, unsatisfactory excursion into freedom ebb away. He worked on forgetting about it, and he felt he succeeded. His final ride was from a New Jersey vegetable truck delivering to Greenwich Village. It rumbled in through the Holland Tunnel. He got out and walked the last mile on Canal and Broadway all the way down to Jody's apartment house, concentrating hard on his desire to see her. He had his own key to her lobby, and he went up in the elevator and knocked on her door. The peephole went dark and light again, and the door opened, and she was standing there in jeans and a shirt, tall and slim and vital. She was the most beautiful thing he had ever seen, but she wasn't smiling at him. Hey, Jody, he said.
There's an FBI agent in my kitchen, she replied.
Why?
Why? She repeated. You tell me.
He followed her into the apartment, through to the kitchen. The bureau guy was a short young man with a wide neck. Blue suit, white shirt, striped tie. He was holding a cell phone up to his face, reporting Reacher's arrival to somebody else. What do you want? Reacher asked him. I want you to wait here, sir, the guy said. About 10 minutes, please. What's this about? You'll find out, sir. 10 minutes is all. Reacher felt like walking out, just to be contrary, but Jody sat down. There was something in her face, something halfway between concern and annoyance. The New York Times was open on the countertop. Reacher glanced at it. Okay, he said. 10 minutes. He sat down, too. They waited in silence. It was nearer 15 minutes than 10. Then the buzzer from the street sounded and the bureau guy went to answer it. He clicked the door release and moved out to the hallway. Jody sat still and passive like a guest in her own apartment. Reacher heard the whine of the elevator. He heard it stop. He heard the apartment door open. He heard footsteps on the maple floor. Alan Deerfield walked into the kitchen. He was in a dark raincoat with the collar turned up. He was moving energetically, and he had sidewalk grit on the soles of his shoes, and it made him loud and invasive. I got 6 people dead in my city, he said. He saw the Times on the counter and walked over and folded it back to reveal the headline. So I got a couple questions, naturally. Reacher looked at him. What questions? Deerfield looked back. Delicate questions. So ask them. Deerfield nodded. First question is from Ms. Jacob. Jody stirred in her chair, didn't look up.
What's the question? She said.
Where have you been the last few days?
Out of town, she said. On business?
Where out of town?
London. Client conference.
London, England?
As opposed to what other Londons?
Deerfield shrugged. London, Kentucky, London, Ohio. There's a London somewhere in Canada, too, I believe. Ontario, maybe.
London, England, Jody said.
You got clients in London, England. Jody was still looking at the floor.
We've got clients everywhere, especially in London, England.
Deerfield nodded. You go by the Concord? She looked up.
Yes, I did, as a matter of fact.
Real quick, right? Jody nodded.
Quick enough.
But expensive.
I guess.
But worth it for a partner on important business. Jody looked at him.
I'm not a partner.
Deerfield smiled. Even better, right? They put an associate on the Concord, gotta mean something. Must mean they like you. Must mean you'll be a partner real soon, if nothing comes along and gets in the way.
Jody said nothing in reply.
So London, Deerfield said. Reacher knew you were there, right?
She shook her head. No, I didn't tell him.
There was a pause.
Scheduled trip? Deerfield asked.
Jody shook her head again.
Last minute.
And Reacher didn't know.
I already told you that.
Okay, Deerfield said. Information is king, is what I say.
I don't have to tell him where I go.
Deerfield smiled. I'm not talking about what information you give Reacher. I'm talking about what information I get out of a situation. Right now I'm getting...
He didn't know where you were. So?
That should have worried him. And it did worry him. Right after he got to Quantico, he was trying to get you on the phone. Office, home, mobile. That night, same thing again. Calling, calling, calling. Couldn't get you. A worried man. Jody glanced up at Reacher, concern in her face. Maybe a little apology.
I should have told him, I guess.
Hey, that's up to you. I don't go around telling people how to conduct their relationships. But the interesting thing is, then he stops calling you. Suddenly he's not calling you anymore. Now why is that? Did he find out you were safe over there in London, England? She started to reply, and then she stopped.
I'll take that for a no, Deerfield said.
You were worried about Petrosian, so you told people in your office to clam up about where you were. So as far as Reacher knew, you were still right here in town. But he's suddenly not worried anymore. He doesn't know you're safe and sound in London, England, but maybe he does know you're safe and sound because of some other reason,
such as
maybe he knows Petrosian isn't going to be around for very much longer. Jody's eyes were back on the floor again. He's a smart guy, Deerfield said. My guess is he whistled up some pal of his to set the cat among the pigeons up here in Chinatown. And then he sat back and waited for the tongs to do what they always do when somebody starts messing with them. And he figures he's safe. He knows we'll never find his busy little pal, and he figures those Chinese boys aren't going to tell us diddly, not in a million years. And he knows the exact moment old Petrosian is getting the good news with the machete, he's locked into a room down in Quantico.
A smart guy.
Jody said nothing.
But a very confident guy,
Deerfield said.
He stopped calling you 2 days before Petrosian finally bought the farm.
There was silence in the kitchen. Deerfield turned to Reacher.
So am I on the money? He asked.
Reacher shrugged. Why should anybody have been worrying about Petrosian? Deerfield smiled again.
Oh, sure, we can't talk about that. We'll never admit Blake said a word to you on that subject. But like I told Ms. Jacob, information is king. I just want to be 100% sure what I'm dealing with here.
If you start it up, just tell me, and maybe I'll pat you on the back for a job well done. But if by some chance it was a genuine dispute, we need to know about it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Reacher said.
So why did you stop calling Miss Jacob?
That's my business.
No, it's everybody's business, Deerfield said.
Certainly it's Miss Jacob's business, right?
And it's mine, too.
So tell me about it.
And don't go thinking you're out of the woods yet, Reacher. Petrosian was a piece of shit, for sure. But he's still a homicide. And we can crank up a pretty good motive for you anyway, based on what was witnessed by 2 credible witnesses the other night in the alley. We could call it a conspiracy with persons unknown. Careful preparation of the case, you could be inside 2 years.
just waiting for the trial. Jury might let you go in the end, but then who really knows what a jury might do?
Reacher said nothing. Jody stood up.
You should leave now, Mr. Deerfield, she said. I'm still his lawyer, and this is an inappropriate forum for this discussion.
Deerfield nodded slowly and looked around the kitchen like he was seeing it for the first time.
Yes, it sure is, Ms. Jacob, he said.
So maybe we'll have to continue this discussion someplace more appropriate at some future time. Maybe tomorrow, maybe next week, maybe next year. Like Mr. Blake pointed out, we know where you both live. He turned on the spot, with the grit on his shoes loud in the silence. They heard him walk through the living room, and they heard the apartment door open and slam shut.
So you took Petrosian out? Jody said.
I never went near him, Reacher replied. She shook her head.
Save that stuff for the FBI, okay? You arranged it, or provoked it, or engineered it, or whatever the correct phrase would be. You took him out, as surely as if you were standing right next to him with a gun.
Reacher said nothing.
And I told you not to do that, she said.
Reacher said nothing.
Deerfield knows you did it, she said.
He can't prove it.
That doesn't matter, she said. Don't you see that? He can try to prove it, and he's not kidding about the 2 years in jail. A suspicion of gang warfare, a thing like that, the courts will back him up all the way. Denial of bail, continuances, the prosecutors will really go to bat for him. It's not an empty threat. He owns you now, like I told you he would.
Reacher said nothing.
Why did you do it?
He shrugged. Lots of reasons. It needed doing. There was a long silence.
Would my father have agreed with you? Jody asked.
Leon, Reacher said. He recalled the photographs in Kozo's packet. Photographs of Petrosian's handiwork. The dead women displayed like centerfolds. Pieces missing, things inserted. Are you kidding? Leon would have agreed with me in a heartbeat.
And would he have gone ahead and done what you did?
Probably. She nodded.
Yes, he probably would. But look around you, okay?
At what?
At everything. What do you see?
He looked around. An apartment? She nodded.
My apartment.
So?
Did I grow up here?
Of course not.
So where did I grow up?
He shrugged. All over the place on army bases like I did.
She nodded. Where did you first meet me?
You know where, Manila, on the base.
Remember that bungalow?
Sure I do. She nodded.
So do I. It was tiny, it stank, and it had cockroaches bigger than my hand. And you know what? That was the best place I ever lived as a kid.
So? She was pointing at her briefcase. It was a leather pilot's case stuffed with legal paper, parked against the wall just inside the kitchen door.
What's that?
Your briefcase.
Exactly. Not a rifle, not a carbine, not a flamethrower.
So?
So I live in a Manhattan apartment instead of base quarters, and I carry a briefcase instead of infantry weapons.
He nodded. I know you do.
But do you know why?
Because you want to, I guess.
Exactly. Because I want to. It was a conscious choice, my choice. I grew up in the army just like you did, and I could have joined up if I'd wanted to, just like you did. But I didn't want to. I wanted to go to college and law school instead. I wanted to join a big firm and make partner, and why was that?
Why?
Because I wanted to live in a world with rules.
Plenty of rules in the army, he said.
The wrong rules, Reacher. I wanted civilian rules, civilized rules.
So what are you saying?
I'm saying I left the military all those years ago, and I don't want to be back in it now.
You're not back in it.
But you make me feel that I am. Worse than the military, this thing with Petrosian, I don't want to be in a world with rules like that. You know I don't.
So what should I have done?
You shouldn't have gotten into it in the first place. That night at the restaurant, you could have walked away and called the cops. That's what we do here.
Here?
In the civilized world.
He sat on her kitchen stool and leaned his forearms on her countertop, spread his fingers wide and placed his palms down flat. The countertop was cold. It was some kind of granite, gray and shiny, milled to reveal tiny quartz speckles throughout its surface. The corners and angles were radiused into perfect quarter circles.
It was an inch thick and probably very